hard work allows you to see how you express your talent. We like to simplify it and say, hey, what can you do off nothing? Well, that's not it. It's all of these different factors that have to align.
Welcome to the Shakeout Podcast. I'm your host, Kate Van Buskirk. When we talk about high achievers, Olympians, record setters, qualifiers for the illustrious Boston Marathon, we often call them talented. But what does talent actually mean? Is it purely innate ability? Is it influenced by external factors? And how can we unlock talent to maximize our potential? In this episode, I chat with two of the smartest guys I know, Alex Hutchinson and Steve Magnus, to try to answer these very big questions. Alex is an author and journalist in Toronto. He writes about the science of endurance and fitness for Outside, the Globe and Mail, and our very own Canadian running magazine. His 2018 bestseller, Endure, is probably sitting on many of your bookshelves right now. Steve is a world-renowned expert on performance. He's coached executives, entrepreneurs, and athletes, including American record holder Sarah Hall. He's also a best-selling author of The Science of Running, The Passion Paradox, and Peak Performance. And as if that's not enough, Steve and Alex were both very successful high school and collegiate runners. In fact, Steve ran what was, at the time, the sixth fastest high school mile in U.S. history. Needless to say, they were the perfect candidates for this conversation about talent. Good afternoon, Alex and Steve. Thank you both so much for joining us on the Shakeout Podcast for this exciting conversation about talent. It's so great to have you both.
Thanks, Kate. It's great to be here, and it's great to have a chance to chat with Steve, who I interact with online a lot, but we don't get a chance to actually speak very much.
That's right. No, this will be a joy. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks so much for making the time. So right off the bat, Alex, a couple of weeks ago, you competed in your first race in quite a while, the Canada Running Series Spring Runoff. What was it like getting back on a race course and how did it go?
I had a really amazing 7 kilometers. Unfortunately, the race was 8 kilometers. So, you know, that's the way it goes. It was my first road race in, gosh, I guess 3 years, I think, since the last Spring Runoff. It's a hilly course. It was a tough race, and I could barely hobble for about 5 days after. I forgot how bad those downhills are, trying to hammer the downhills of High Park.
Yeah, I think that's one of the joys, but also the hard reminders for people getting back into racing again after a couple years without it. You know, we're all so excited to be back on these mass start lines again, but we kind of forget what it feels like to really push ourselves and go to the well. So I'm glad to hear that you've recovered, Alex. I know how hard that course is. I've done it several times myself, so kudos on that. Steve, what's your relationship like with running these days? Have you been doing any racing?
I have not. I have given up on racing, but I try to stay moderately fit. So I have a weird goal right now, which is essentially once every couple of weeks, I go run a 5-minute mile and I decide if it's incredibly hard, I need to train more. And if it's easy, then I'm in a good spot. So I'm just trying to be like moderately fit, not trying to do the races like Alex is.
That's a great approach. I think there's probably lots of folks who maybe had more competitive past lives in the running world and who still have those, you know, semi-regular benchmarks. So I love that that's your go-to. Alex, do you have any more competitive goals in the horizon?
I am running the Bum Run 5K this weekend, which is another, it's sort of similar to Steve's 5-minute mile. I except it's, you know, a 5K. Unlike the Spring Runoff, the 5K is a repeatable distance where I know what times correspond to what. And it's an opportunity maybe once a year or more to find out if how hard I think I'm running corresponds to reality. And lately the answer is always no, it doesn't. But that's a good lesson to get. And it's nothing motivates me to get out for longer runs or harder workouts than realizing that what I thought was pretty fast was actually much slower than I thought I was training. Not to get too far off track, but I will admit in preparing for these last few races, I did some workouts with my old workout group. I was on the track for the first time in years and we were doing, I think it was 600 reps, and I couldn't help but notice the 200 splits that I was just felt like I was sprinting to get. I was like, I remember doing a workout, you know, 15 years ago where this was the pace I ran for the float recoveries between, you know, the hard sections, and now I'm sprinting. And how was that the recovery? It's just, you know, it's good to run a measured course every once in a while. I mean, the news isn't always good, especially as you get older, but it's, you know, it's better to live in reality than to kid yourself and wake up one morning and discover that you've been lying to yourself.
Well, that's a great segue because you both come from quite competitive, high-performing backgrounds. So maybe we can start by each of you in a nutshell describing your running backgrounds from those high school and university days. Alex, take us back to your glory days.
Yeah, I started seriously in high school. I joined the University of Toronto Track Club when I was 15 or something and started training seriously from that point. I had a promising high school career, but not a fast one. On the topic of talent, I think I had some races that suggested I had some talent, but in university, I ran 3:42 for 1500, which is roughly equivalent to, unfortunately, just slower than a 4-minute mile, which I'm still very proud of. So that was in university. And then I kept training seriously on the track till I was about 28, interrupted by a bunch of injuries, which is not unusual. And then even after that, I kept training and ran cross country. I ran at some world cross country championships and then kind of tapered off from there, but have kept training and occasionally competing ever since. So I was a very serious middle distance runner from high school through to my late 20s. With a little bit of other cross country and road running thrown in.
And Steve, how about you? We put a bit of a spoiler in our intro, but fill us in on the rest of the story.
Yeah. So I was a soccer player growing up until it got to, I think, my freshman year of high school. I went out for cross country because I was, had pretty good endurance and all that stuff. And the coach recruited me and I ran too fast my first race. Like I did too well, I guess. And he said, he came over to me and said, Steve, you don't need to play soccer. You need to run. You could be really good at this. And I just kind of, unlike Alex, I showed talent, I guess, very early. So my freshman year of high school, I ran 4:22 in the mile, which was one of the better freshmen in the country. And then by the time I graduated high school, I ran 4:01 for the mile or 3:43 for 1500. Which at that time was the best in the nation for the U.S. that year. And then, unlike Alex, I didn't get better. So I stagnated in college and kind of hung around that kind of mid-340s level. Although I made NCAAs and cross country and stuff like that, I just kind of stuck there. And then I gave running a go for a couple years afterwards, training with some high-level athletes. But again, just kind of stagnated and still enjoyed it and still competing, but had to like reshape my expectations because when you perform really well when you're young, you often get saddled with like very high expectations on what's going to happen. So I had to like kind of come to terms with that and as Alex eloquently put it, deal with reality, which is a huge part of running.
For sure. And we're going to come back to that concept of early talent identification in a little bit. But before we get there, we're here to talk about talent, and it's a topic of a lot of debate. People have different definitions of talent, how that definition might change as we start to understand different elements of mental performance and things like that. But just to frame this out, I'm going to put you both in the hot seat and ask by getting each of you to give us your personal definitions of talent. And of course, we'll get into all the nitty-gritty as our conversation progresses. But just as a jumping off point, Alex, how do you define talent?
Oh, that is the million-dollar question. I think that's actually the question we're going to wrestle with for this whole conversation. So let me start by saying what talent isn't. Talent isn't just being fast, right? Otherwise, we would just call it being fast. So you can imagine two people who with exactly the same personal bests, and we might choose to, I'd say, one of them is really talented or more talented than the other for reasons that, that may have to do with, for example, how much training one of them did to get there compared to the other. So there's something in this definition of talent where we're looking at the ratio of like work input to performance output, and if you're really talented, if you get a lot of fast performance out of a little bit of work. I think more generally, what we think of as talent is maybe a projection into the future of how fast we think someone could run if everything goes perfectly. And let me give not to ramble on too long, but I think the way a lot of us think of talent is exactly what Steve described, which is like the mile run in phys ed class when you're 12 and no one's really been training. Whoever runs fastest is the most talented. And that's certainly it's a good predictor of how fast you might run 10 years from there, but it's not the only one. And there's other things like trainability. You know, once you start training, how well does your body respond to that? And that's definitely a form of talent that's going to influence your, you know, how fast you're going to run in 10 years, but it's more invisible. We tend to, I think, as a society, we fixate on the, what can you do off the couch? What can you do with no training? But there's a lot of other aspects of talent, like trainability or like ability to tolerate high training loads without getting injured. And then, as you mentioned, Kate, mental factors. So a true definition of talent, we'll have to get all those other things in. But I guess, yeah, I just want to emphasize, it's not just being fast and it's not just running fast in you know, phys ed class.
Yeah, that's great, Alex. I love when you ask someone what something is and they say, let me tell you what it's not. That's great. Steve, how about you? How do you start to define talent?
Yeah, no, I think Alex is spot on. I really don't have anything else to add except that I think our common perception, right, is that talent is, hey, what could I do if I was coming off the couch or I was that kid in PE class and showed up? And I think that, as Alex pointed out, that gets at one level of it. But what I like to say is there's so many different permutations of talent. My talent could be that, you know, off of no training, I can do amazing things. It could be that off of once I start to train, my body is incredibly adaptable and I'll make a gigantic jump. It could be that I can stay in the game for 20 years because my body is, you know, resilient and able to bounce back and handle loads so that my talent isn't expressed until I've spent 10 years doing the thing. And everybody else who was my competitor maybe is injured, hurt, or like wasn't able to do it at that level. So I think the key takeaway for me on talent is we like the nice and simple. We not like to say, oh, it's our natural innate ability. Well, that's true, but there's so many different factors that go into talent that it's about like finding what one kind of applies in your situation, I think.
And I'll just jump in here and say that if you kind of try to reverse engineer talent, you take anyone who has achieved a high level in running or anything else, you can then identify the factors that have enabled them to reach that level of performance, and you can call that talent. Like, as Steve said, there's a billion different pathways. And we can say that person's talent was like, you know, was staying in the game for long or whatever. You know, it's almost by definition, if you make it to a high level, you must have been talented. You can't, because that's kind of what talent is supposed to predict, that you can make it to a high level. It just turns out that we can only see with retrospect in a lot of cases what the talent was that got you there. And so the lesson for pointing forward and asking, am I talented? What level can I get to? Is that you really can't know all the factors that might, you know, there's a cliche, which is, you know, the harder I worked, the more talented I got. And it's a cliche, but there's a kernel of truth to it, because you don't know, like for trainability, for example, you will never know if you have exceptional trainability, exceptional response to training, until you train. So you can't know until you do it. So which kind of, in a way, defeats the purpose of like talking about it as a predictor, because you won't know until you've done it.
So as I expected, and as both of you made note of in the preface to this conversation, there are a number of different factors that are complicating, right, when it comes to what we call talent. But it sounds like one of the areas of agreement here is that there are physical or, you know, physiological attributes that we can link to talent. And then there are some other things that maybe come out in less obvious or less observable ways. So let's start with that first one. When we talk about talent, what are some of the physiological traits that we look for or attribute to talent?
So let me just start out with a shout out to David Epstein's book, The Sports Gene, which really shaped my thinking about talent, and I think, you know, shaped society's thinking about talent. And there's a great quote from David's book, which is now, I guess, 9 years old now, so it's been out for a while. But he quotes, I think, Carl Foster, who's a very good exercise physiologist, saying, and he's talking about the context of genetic testing. Which genes can you look for that will tell you whether Johnny should play quarterback or be, you know, going out for a different sport? And he said, look, the best tool we have to predict who's going to be fast is the stopwatch. And so this, it kind of sounds like I'm going back and contradicting what I said before, which is that the eighth grade phys ed class is not the only arbiter of talent, but it's a pretty darn good one. It, you know, to first order, if you had to pick your dream team for 2035, you'd go to the local elementary school with your stopwatch and see who's fast. And that's going to pick up some things like how high is your VO2 max in the absence of systematic training, which is a pretty good indicator. And so there's some of those physiological indicators. So that's where I would start, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think on a physiological side, I mean, we could get as complicated as you want in terms of VO2 max and lactate threshold and heart size and muscle characteristics. But the reality is, if you look at the science, we can't slice or dice these things apart finely enough to be like, hey, if you have this characteristic, like this means you're talented or this means you're going to, you know, achieve amazing things. I mean, if you look at VO2 max, for example, sure, you have to have a relatively high one, but if we look at elite athletes, you essentially have to be in the club, which means if you're above, I don't know, 65, 70 or more, then you're in the club. And it really doesn't matter if you're 70 or 85. Like you can't distinguish who is going to be the race winner out of that group. So I think on some of these physiological characteristics, it's like the talent is, are you in the club to be able to do the elite stuff or not? And then if you're in the club, great. But that doesn't distinguish whether you're going to be the best in the world or the, you know, 500th best, because they all have varying, you know, similarities on this.
Steve, didn't you do some genetic testing? Just thinking back to talent and like, so tell that story.
Yeah, thanks for the reminder. So I did, you know, some genetic testing, 23andMe, and they have these little predictors for different things. One of them is what kind of like athlete should you be? Basically, are you more sprint orientated, sprint and power, or endurance orientated? And it's all based on a little bit of research that connects, you know, one little gene to being better or worse in this. Well, mine comes out as I am a power athlete. And if you can look at me as my 5'10", 145 pound, you know, distance runner, who spent his lifetime running 100 miles a week and couldn't, you know, lift anything to save my life, you can tell that, like, obviously that's a very poor predictor. And, you know, I like to laugh about it, but I think what it gets at is that these traits or these characteristics, these performance things, performance in a nutshell, is so freaking complex that we can't simplify it into these nice, easy, like, well, you have this characteristic, so you're going to be able to sprint or jump or you know, run far or whatever have you.
Yeah, and just to jump on that, like, to emphasize how crazy this is, like, this gene test that Steve did, there were companies about 15 years ago selling this. There were, you know, breathless articles in the New York Times about how this company was helping athletes or helping parents, you know, channel their kids at age 5 to, oh, well, he should be playing football and she should be doing, you know, swimming or whatever. And it's not that the science is non-existent. The science is real. Like, these are traits that you're more likely to make it to the Olympic 100-meter final if you have Steve's power profile. It's just that, you know, in a menu of so many different traits that go together to dictate quote-unquote talent, no one of them is essential, and no one of them is, you know, highly predictive. Because here we have a guy who's literally one of the fastest high school milers in the history of the United States, who is being told you're going to be really good at pole vault and 100 meters. Like it to me, that's like one of the greatest illustrations of the dangers of starting to think that we can predict more than we can.
So that was going to be one of my questions. Is there such a thing as a talent gene or talent genes? And so then one of the things that reminds me of, Steve, you know, you were predicted to be a power athlete and you went on to become a really phenomenal middle distance runner.
It's good he didn't get that prediction before he made his choices. He only got that prediction in retrospect, thank goodness.
Right, right. And again, we'll talk more about early talent identification and its pros and cons. But one of the things that this leads me to is the potential difference between various event groups. Are there certain events where physical talent is perhaps a stronger indicator of success compared to others? So I'm thinking about the difference, for a fairly extreme example, between a world-class 100-meter sprinter, let's say, and a world-class marathoner. So what roles do physical talent on the one hand and things like trainability on the other play in different event groups?
Sure. Yeah. So the wonderful thing about all of these different physical characteristics is that they all have different degrees of trainability individually. So in a nutshell, we know that most endurance capacities are easier to train than our explosive or speed power activities, right? You look at sprinting. Yes, we can improve that with training, but the what I would call the gap between our maybe peak potential in the 100 and our trainability is smaller than, let's say, the gap for most endurance components, right? And the other thing I'd say on this is there's not only this endurance or this event-specific category, but there's also like a individual characteristics on how trainable different things are. So if I have a high lactate threshold, like that's going to be more trainable than something that maybe my 400 meter time or something like that. Like I might have a little wiggle room there, but not as much as, you know, for some of the endurance events.
You know, Kate, I just want to jump in and actually jump back to the previous topic about genetics, because I don't want to give the impression that, because there is a stream of thought over the last, let's say, 20 years that talent is kind of an illusion, that if you work hard enough, you can create your own talent. And what I've been saying so far maybe kind of feeds into that narrative. And what I would say is, just because Steve's genetic test did a terrible job of predicting his athletic potential and focus doesn't mean there aren't genetic constraints. Nobody has any trouble understanding that it's not a lack of hard work that prevented me from being a center in the NBA. You know, my height and my size and my lack of talent and my inability to we have a long list of why I'm not a center in the NBA. But the first one is my height. You know, you can just eliminate me right away. And my height, it's not that I didn't work hard enough at my height drills. My height is genetically determined. Now, which gene was it that determined my height? There are, I can't remember the latest estimates, but I think there's thousands of genes that have gone into contributing height. So there is no height gene, but height is genetically determined. And similarly, it's very hard to measure or say, this is what your VO2 max can get up to. But there are definitely genetic components to VO2 max. And there are people who have a much higher ceiling than other people, regardless of how much work they do. There is such a thing as talent. So I realize it kind of feels like I'm flipping the narrative halfway through, but it's a question of balance. It's like for the people who are saying yes, we can do give me a $500 and a prick of blood and I'll tell you whether you're talented, they're full of crap. But for the people who are saying there's no such thing as talent, just some people work harder or want it more than others, they're also full of crap, because and you can go back to the eighth grade gym class mile or whatever, you can see that some people can, with very little effort, run times that other people might actually never achieve, no matter how much work they put in.
So this is a relationship that I really want to explore more. And I think that this is probably what is of particular interest to many people who are not, you know, elite athletes, but they might have high personal goals, whatever those may be. And part of this, of course, is acknowledging that for many of us, success is personally determined, right? If we acknowledge that we're never going to stand on the top of an Olympic podium, then how high can we achieve personally? How far can we get? How fast can we run? Where does our own potential lie? So I think that's where the relationship between hard work and innate ability is really interesting. One of the examples that's been brought up a lot in these types of conversations is Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hour rule. You know, if you work hard enough, to your point, Alex, you can overcome perhaps a deficit of innate talent. So first of all, is that an accurate distillation of the 10,000 hour concept? And if so, what is problematic, do you think, with that way of thinking about how we maximize our potential? Or maybe the better question is, how do we find out where our talent ceiling lies? Basically, can we outwork a lack of innate ability?
I would say that sometimes in life, there are useful lies, and the 10,000 hour rule might be one of those. Because no, like, again, I could put in 100,000 hours and I'm still not going to be 6'11 and able to dunk. You can't just outwork any barrier. And the talent involved in running a 202 marathon or something like that is less visible. It's harder to see than height is. But I tell you, it's real. But on the other hand, 99.999% of us never put in the work to find out what our ceiling is. And at this point in human history, there isn't a test you can take to find out, okay, I can be this good in bowling, but I can be that good in badminton, so I'm going to spend all my time on badminton. You're only going to find out how good a bowler or badminton player you are by doing it. And the 10,000 hour rule encourages people to do it and to put in the 10,000 hours and find out how good they can be. And my impression is that very few people who put in their 10,000 or however many hours regret it. And like, oh man, I only got this good and I thought I could be that good. Anyone who really puts in the work to push their limits, I think ends up enjoying that. And one thing I would say about running, the place it occupies in my life, and I think the place it occupies in the lives of a lot of runners, is that it's one of the very few things where we've said, you know what the hell, for whatever reason, for whatever mental condition I have, I really want to know how good I can be at running. So I'm going to put in those 10,000 hours. And there's so many other things in life that I've been interested in and, pursued for a little while, or where I feel like, oh, I didn't really know how good I could be because I didn't get the opportunity. I didn't make the team or whatever. Running is a place where you can say, I'm going to put in my 10,000 hours plus or minus however many. I'm going to put in the work. And I don't know what my ceiling will be, but I'm going to find it out. And so I have a soft spot for the 10,000 hour rule, even though it's been totally misinterpreted in the popular narrative.
Yeah, I agree with Alex. The way I like to look at it is hard work allows you to explore and see how you express your talent. Like, as Alex said, we don't know. I didn't know that I was going to be a good runner until I started actually training at running, right? And that's so true for so many things. But the flip side of that is, like, the hard work is necessary, but it's not sufficient to reach, you know, the highest level. Like, you need other stuff. And we don't know if we have that other stuff. There is no predictor. There is no test that we can take unless we go out and put in the work and see kind of where our limits are. Like, if you look at Alex and I's story, is we plateaued at different times, but just like every runner alive, we all plateau at some point. And whether that's going to be at the 2-hour marathon or at 220 or 240, like, you can't really know. And there's so many stories out there of athletes who maybe didn't express talent early on, but then over years, like, you know, found their way down to something pretty impressive. And I think that when I think of the 10,000 hours, I don't think of it as like, oh, some hope of like, hey, if I just work hard enough, I can be great at anything. No, that's a lie. That's not true. But I think what it does tell me is if I put in the work, I'm going to get a little bit better of an idea of where my true talent lies and explore that a little bit. And that's fine. That's okay.
And I think just jumping off something Steve was saying, it's like there is something special about seeing someone who was not the grade 8 star achieve something high. And I think that speaks to how deeply the sort of talent narrative is embedded, where we assume that whoever starts fast is going to end up being the fastest person. So, like, among my contemporaries in Canadian running, I always love thinking about Reid Coolsatt's progression. You know, he was a 2-time Olympic marathoner for Canada who was kind of a okay, like, mid-level high school runner. I don't think he made the University of Guelph's cross-country team in his first year. At least he didn't make their traveling seven. And he got steadily better to the point that he was, by the time he finished at Guelph, he was a good sort of regional level runner. Not someone I would ever consider losing to, not to pat myself on the back here. I had some races where he was close to me and I was like, who's that clown with the, you know, curly hair coming close to me? You know, But if you look at his progression, he used to have a website where he posted his yearly progression. It's like, I don't know how many years it was. It was like 10 years. His 5K PB came down, you know, 5 or 10 seconds every year. And all of a sudden he's running 13:20. And I'm like, oh my God, he's in a different stratosphere from me. And he was a guy who, even when he finished university, I would have classified as a guy who worked hard but didn't have a ton of talent. But he just, his trainability however we want to characterize it, he just kept getting better. And that's, and you know, and ended up move up to the marathon and then made the Olympics. And it's like, it's an amazing story. And it's much more interesting to watch that story than, as much as I love some of our track stars who are like, you know, showed up at 14, you know, wearing steel-toed boots and, you know, won the city championships or whatever. That happens too. And that's awesome. And I'm happy for that too. But there's, for the rest of us, quote unquote, it's exciting to see that sometimes people are still discovering the extent of their talent, you know, 10 years after they started training pretty hard. And most of us aren't lucky enough to you know, the longer you run, the more you appreciate every time you get a PB and you celebrate whatever the victories are. But to know that, you know, just because you've plateaued doesn't necessarily mean this is where my ultimate genetic potential is. Because that's, I mean, sometimes it's true that the plateau remains your plateau. Like at a certain point, you run your lifetime best and you don't run better. But most runners who train for any period of time will have gone through some period where they've plateaued and then they start to think, I guess this is it. I guess this is what my DNA says I can run for this distance. And then something changes. Maybe they train differently. Maybe they just get a different mindset. Maybe they just get lucky. And for whatever reason, they keep getting faster. And so I think that's kind of an important message to bear in mind, akin to the 10,000 hour thing, that, yeah, you never know. You never know. There is no, we can't write a formula that says, yeah, you've done everything you could do. You can walk away from the sport now because there's nothing more you can do.
Yeah, I love that example of Reed Coolset. And again, like you said, it's impossible to figure out what the precise combination is of, you know, intrinsic ability, maybe being later to develop, how hard someone works, etc. But that's the second piece to this. We talked about the physical ability. But do you think that in our definition of talent, we can include things like toughness and stubbornness and ability to withstand extreme discomfort? I mean, Alex, in your book, Endure, that's one of the ways that you define endurance. You use the metaphor of holding your finger in the flame. You know, the person who can withstand that high level of discomfort or pain the longest is often going to be one of the more successful endurance athletes. So if we're talking about talent in these innate terms around physical ability, how much of talent also involves mental ability, and how much of our mental fortitude is innate versus learned or environmental?
I wrote about a study a month or two ago, where they had a bunch of elite Swiss junior cyclists, and they were going to have them race up a mountain. And the question was, what tests can we do beforehand that'll predict what the finishing order of this is going to be? So they did a bunch of standard tests like VO2 max and I can't remember, cycling economy tests and maximum leg strength tests, those sorts of things, that anything you can think of that you might want to know to predict who's going to be able to climb up this mountain. They also had some psychological questionnaires and to predict things like persistence and I can't remember what the other ones were. And when they used when they sort of ran it through a big statistical analysis, their conclusion was basically, I mean, I'm sort of simplifying, but 70% or 77% of performance was predictable from the physiological parameters and 23% was predictable from the psychological parameters. Now, that's specific to this particular task, these particular athletes and the particular things they chose to measure. But it's clear that performance is affected by psychological questionnaires. And there's another paper that I haven't actually read yet. I just saw and I'm planning to hopefully write about, which was six Canadian sports psychologists who work with the Olympic teams have spent 2 years coming up with what they called the gold medal sports psychological profile or something. I can't remember the acronym, where they identified, I think, 11 traits in three categories that this is what you need to be a top athlete. So I think we can all agree that these sorts of traits matter. Then the question is, which traits are we talking about? And then to what extent are these innate? Because when we talk about talent, we're kind of talking about an empty vessel. Like it's not talent to go to a high school that has a really good coach. And it's not talent to be born in Kenya with constrained economic opportunities, which give you amazing motivation to train really hard. These are environmental factors. And so it becomes hard with the psychological factors to figure out, am I really persistent and really willing to undergo discomfort because I'm born that way? Or is it something in my upbringing? Is it some trauma that I underwent as a kid, which is actually something that's not unusual among elite athletes? So it's hard to identify, but I would say there is some aspect that is probably innate, that there's some portion of the psychological profile. Some people are just born more inclined to want to do the things necessary to be a top athlete.
Yeah. So what I'd add there is a couple years ago, I got really interested in the psychological side of things. And I decided to send out all these validated, research validated questionnaires on everything from like grit and persistence and how they viewed stress. And I just pulled out like my Rolodex of elite endurance athletes and just said, hey, can you fill this all out? So I had all this data and I completely expected, hey, the Olympians, the record holders, like they were going to be more gritty and view stress like as a challenge. And the reality is it was all over the place, right? I had college walk-ons who barely made the team as grittier than American record holders in distance events. And the takeaway I got from that is not that this stuff isn't important. I think Alex is spot on. It is. But it's just like the physical, aspect, and that there are so many different combinations or avenues to get to our performance that, some people can reach the Olympics with a high level of persistence, but they might have like this, they might be motivated by threatening things or see stress as detrimental, but they're able to overcome it or deal with that in a different way. So I think once again, we have all these constructs, and even that study Alex mentioned, I haven't read it and it sounds fascinating on the Canadian psychologist, but we have this like these paradigms on like, this is what a gold medal is. This is like the characteristics you need. And I think there's truth behind that, but it's just like the running stuff. It's just like the physical. We can get there in a million different paths. And if you don't score high on your quote-unquote mental toughness, it's not the end of the world. And the other thing that I'd add as well is I think there is some heritability to this, but it's also incredibly, trainable. So for this, I turn to studies. If you look at research on people who practice like Buddhist meditation for a while, there's all sorts of research, including like fMRI studies on brain scans that shows they essentially change how they perceive and handle and how their brain handles like pain and discomfort. So that might be at the extreme end, but in a lot of ways, we're doing the same thing when we're going out for our tempo run or our long run, which is like, spending a lot of time in our head, getting used to discomfort and like navigating it in a different way.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time, or I wrote a bunch about stuff like motivational self-talk and the importance of positive mental thoughts. And anytime I would talk about that, I'd hear from people, from athletes who were like, actually I've always had my best performances when I'm like super negative, when I'm angry, when I'm motivated by fear and doubt. That, and it's like, yeah, it's true. In the same way that, you could have Frank Shorter with a low VO2 max and great running economy be an Olympic marathon medalist. And then you could have Steve Prefontaine or, someone else who has a high VO2 max and low running economy. There's, as Steve said, there's different roads to the top. And it's an important thing to remember anytime we start to kind of be normative about these are the thoughts you have to have if you want to be a top athlete. This is what you have to think in response to stress. It's like, there are some general guidelines that these seem to work well for people overall, but there's huge variability in the way you can do it. So I think it's probably important not to pathologize, not to make people feel that there's something wrong with them if they don't do it in the way that the gold medal profile suggests.
So obviously it's a messy concept, and there are many contributing factors that coalesce differently for different individuals. Understanding that, I'm curious to know who you think are some of the most talented runners that you've come across. And conversely, some runners who have overcome a supposed sort of talent deficit early on. Alex, maybe you can speak from the Canadian perspective and Steve from the American.
So I think the example I'll give, for least talented, and I don't mean this as a slam, I'll go with Reid Quilsat because you know, he's a guy, yeah, again, year after year, I would say, well, he's topped out. Like he really exceeded my expectations, but that's all there is. And then he would get faster. On the most talented side, one of the guy that pops to mind is Justin Knight. He came up through the University of Toronto Track Club, which is the club that I was associated with at the time. And I wasn't training with the group anymore when he started showing up. But one of my friends who was still training with the group came to me when Justin Knight first showed up. And he had showed up in basketball shoes and run like 8:50 for 3,000 or something like that. He was like, yeah, there's this kid, Justin Knight. He wants to run 8:10 next year, I think it was, something like that. And he, you know, since you've run that fast, I was wondering if you have any tips for what it takes to run 8:10. And I was like, tell the guy to simmer down. Like, you know, he ran 8:50. That's great. That doesn't mean he's going to run 8:10 next year. What he should try to do is run faster than he's currently running. And, you know, if every year he runs a little faster than he did last year, he will end up being pretty fast the longer he keeps doing that. And the next year he ran like 8:10 or something like that, on 1 year. And he was doing super light training and playing basketball. And I was like, oh, this guy just ran 8:10 as a 16-year-old or something like that on super light training. And the next year he ran like 8 flat or under 8 minutes, went down to the United States to run in college. He won some NCAA titles and he was famously, again, training at a very, he was undertrained. He was running at Syracuse and doing, I can't remember, you know, like, I think maximum 50 miles a week, maybe, you know, 80K a week, maybe even less than that. And this goes back to this sort of conception of talent as getting amazing performances out of a small amount of work, which you then use to extrapolate that, oh, then if he does more work, he's going to get faster. And as someone, I ran my best times on relatively low training. So I expected that I would get faster when I trained harder, and I didn't. I trained harder and harder and harder and harder, and I got the same or slower. But Justin Knight also had this second ingredient, which was that not only was he just ferociously talented on light training, as he started to train harder, he kept getting faster and faster and faster. And to the point where he, I can't remember what place he came at the Olympics last year, but he was, top 10 at the Olympics, and is, you know, threatening. He's a reasonable threat to win an Olympic medal. And so my friend still brings up that conversation when he asked me about Justin Knight as a 15-year-old. And I was like, dude, just relax. The chances of him running 8:10 or ever in his life are extremely low. I was like, well, okay. Justin Knight is very talented.
Yeah, I'm really glad you were wrong about that, Alex. And I'm sure Justin is as well. And it's interesting. That brings to mind two other Canadian standouts, Andre DeGrasse and Marco Arope. They both have similar stories in that they didn't get into high-level track until their later years in high school. And they both showed up to their first track practice or track meet, you know, in basketball shorts and basketball shoes, and really had not expressed a ton of interest or necessarily ability in running very early on. But they each developed incredibly quickly into superstar runners. I think those stories are, you know, are really fun and a joy to sort of watch evolve. Steve, from the American context, who stands out as a ridiculously talented runner and why?
Yeah, definitely. You know, the name that pops into my head when I think of talented runners is Alan Webb, who is famous for running 3:53 in the mile as a high schooler. So he had that early phenom and then went on to run 3:46 for the mile as a professional. And I was fortunate to train with him for a couple years while I was in grad school. And I'd just be blown away. And this is, you know, the year after he ran 3:46, essentially. So he was near the top of his game. And I'd just be blown away what this guy could handle. So I just remember one of the first practices that I ever showed up with Alan. In my head, I'm thinking, oh, you know, I ran 100 and up to 120 miles a week. Like, I can handle this stuff. I'll probably get my doors blown off, but like the volume of work is no problem. And I show up, and for about 2 hours before the workout, Alan's doing this elaborate warm up and all these plyos and all these drills before we even get to the workout. And I was exhausted before we even start. Then we start and we go and he runs, I don't know, you know, endless 800s with the last one being, you know, the last several being at 2 minutes or better, right? And I'm exhausted. I'm thinking, okay, the workout's done. I only did half of it. Like, time to go home. But no, Alan goes into the gym, lifts heavy for like 45 minutes to an hour, maxing out, like near max effort on all this stuff. And then afterwards does some more drills, some more general strength, cools down, and then is done for the day. And that first day of practice was like from 8 a.m. until 1 p.m. And we didn't cover that much mileage, but it was just the insanity of the workload that he had built himself up to handle at that time period just blew me away. And it was like no big deal for Alan. He was just like, oh, great, another day at the office. Like, I'll see you tomorrow. So that gets, I think he's the perfect example, because he has this like early phenom, was a swimmer and then ran super fast. And then over his career, like, had that same thing that Justin Knight had, which was like this ability to respond and handle incredible amounts of workloads that most people would have walked away and been like, you know what? Like, I'm going home. But at the same point, I think for Alan, like, his great talent of being able to do crazy things got in the way, because like our tendency is to like, oh, hard work gets us there, so I'm just going to keep doubling down. Well, eventually that's not like the path towards future improvement or staying where you are.
You know, I'll just jump in and say Alan Webb is a fascinating example. I mean, his career was just so interesting, so many ups, so many downs. He ran a 1500 at age, I think, 39 last weekend. And it was, you know, because he's such a legend, there was a lot of speculation, like, how fast will Alan Webb run at age 39? He hasn't trained seriously in a long time, but he's been running for the last, I don't know, sounds like for the last 6 months or a year or something. He's been doing workouts. He's been racing some road races. So how fast is a guy who was, you know, the legend among legends of early talent and then peak professional talent? And he ran 4:13 for 1500, I think it was. And I want to be very careful that I'm not casting aspersion on a 4:13 1500, which I couldn't run to save my life right now. But it's interesting because the talent picture and the sort of the saying of talent doesn't go away would have said, for a guy like Alan Webb at age 39, as long as he's got both his legs, he's never going to struggle to run, you know, slower than 4 minutes or whatever. But yeah, the work part, as Steve was saying, the workload, the ability to work was part of his talent. And probably there was also some emotional component too. When he was training, it was like, he was an intense guy, right? Like, I'm sure he is an intense guy, but he's probably not an intense guy about running anymore. His whole self-esteem is no longer tied up into it. And so part of his talent may have been the ability to dig really deep. And maybe that's sort of, at 39, it's not all about that anymore. And he's just happy to go out and run hard rather than inhumanly hard. I don't know. Like, I haven't talked to him or anything, so this is all rampant speculation from a distance. But it's interesting to see the youth venom come back and run a 1500 at age 39.
Yeah, no, I was just, I think you're spot on. I mean, one of Alan's biggest talents is he could channel this intensity into workouts and racings that I've never seen in anybody else, which is also, again, a downfall to a degree, or something that can bite you. So it's a fascinating example. And I think for our conversation, it gets to the nuance of talent. We like to simplify it and say, hey, what can you do off nothing? That's your talent. Well, that's not it. It's all of these different factors that have to align.
And just thinking again about Alan's race at age 39 and relating it to the average person, thinking, how fast can I get? Well, I'll tell you, among the people I train with, some of whom are late onset runners who took up running in their 30s and are curious as to how fast they can get, how fast they could have gotten if they'd started earlier. And some of them are faster than, at age 39 or even older, or faster than 4:13. They were very fascinated to think that, oh, this guy who's like the paragon of talent, he's like the, you want to talk about talent in middle distance, you talk about Alan Webb. It's like, oh, I just ran faster than him at a similar age for 1500. Maybe I'm talented. Maybe I have to reassess what it is that I'm achieving right now in my own race.
Yeah, there's hope for all of us. Steve, you tweeted a while back saying talent doesn't always express itself right away. Some people's talent is that they're a high responder to training or learning. They need to spend the time doing the work before they can fully express their gift. We tend to overvalue those who show great initial promise. And this really gets back to everything we're talking about here. The piece about early identification of talent is really interesting because it often leads to very early specialization. And I'm wondering if you can speak to some of the potential harm or pitfalls of placing really high value on young talent identification.
Yeah, I'll start. I think it's a dangerous game to play because talent, future ability is incredibly hard to predict, as we've outlined throughout this conversation. And what happens is if we narrow too early, it not only can impact our physical adjustment and abilities and all that stuff, but I think more importantly is it can shift us psychologically, right? Two important things happen when we kind of narrow early on or try and identify talent early on. Is one, we have a higher chance of having our identity get intertwined with the thing we're doing, so that running becomes the only thing. It becomes who I am. And that makes us incredibly fragile, because if all I am is a runner, then if I start losing races, then it's not, hey, I lost at this race. It's that I am like, I'm a loser. Like, I'm not good enough. And then the other thing that I think is important is that early success shifts our motivation. And what decades of research shows us is that, you know, we're both going to have motivation from like external things and internal things. But if we can keep the internal just in balance and high enough, we're going to have more sustainable success over the long term. And that's what the data shows too on those who make it to the elite level, is they generally tend to be more intrinsically motivated. But success, early success shifts our perspective. It starts to have us put more emphasis on the external, on the rewards, the accolades, whether our parents approve of like what we're doing, or our coach gives us, you know, whatever valuation that he can. So I think those two components like make it very tricky for people who, you know, have that early success or talent.
I think what Steve said is those things are the most important points to bear in mind for early talent identification. But I think you can even extend that and say, let's say as a parent, and I have a 6 and 8 year old kids, so I'm thinking about this stuff a lot right now. Let's say as a parent, you're like, well, I don't care about their mental well-being. I want them to go to the Olympics. You shouldn't do that, but let's say you say that. The literature still is pretty clear that you're not giving your kid a leg up by sending them, at least in sports, in sports like running and many other sports, by committing them to specialize early, like before puberty, in a sense. If you look at the trajectories of elite athletes, the ones who make it to the very top, they tend to specialize later, often like 15, 16 years old. And there's a lot of factors that go into that. Probably some of the sort of fragility that Steve talks about and the motivational stuff. There's also the longer you delay before specializing, the better you're likely, the more you're likely to make a good match to the sport that's really right for you, rather than that your parents think is right for you or whatever. You try different sports and you realize, you know what? I should be a rower because I've got really long arms or whatever the case may be. And you develop other muscle patterns, motor patterns, anticipation. Like, there's a lot of crossover between sports and specializing for most sports. I mean, if you want to be a gymnast, you can't wait till you're 18 or whatever. But for running, at least, I think there's just a whole bunch of pitfalls for early specialization and a whole bunch of advantages to having a sort of quote unquote sampling period where you try different things and have a chance to, you know, God forbid, have some fun.
Yeah, those are such good points. I know that the reasons for this are, you know, myriad and complex, but I think about the number of athletes who were like the biggest superstars in high school, you know, kids who were winning OFSA, which is our Ontario Provincial Championships. And it's a meet that's often attended by a lot of college and university recruiters. And some of these OFSA champions never went on to have collegiate careers, never mind post-collegiate professional running careers. And then on the flip side, there are many of my friends and competitors who were frankly pretty mediocre high school and even collegiate runners who've gone on to become Olympians or other, you know, high achievers, and they credit their eventual success and now, you know, longevity in sport to being later bloomers. So I think that those points you're making are incredibly important, especially, you know, for parents who are listening and potentially thinking about directing their kids towards sports specialization early on.
Yeah, I would say just, you know, to the other parents out there on the topic of talent, if your kid's got talent, it will be discovered. It's not, don't panic. It's not being hidden under a bushel and it's going to, you're going to miss that opportunity because you didn't get them to the, you know, the travel lacrosse team or whatever. There will be plenty of opportunities. And if you can foster a lifelong healthy relationship with physical activity, with sport, and with these sorts of things, that's going to be even as someone who values, I value high performance, I value trying to make the Olympics, you know, it's amazing, but you don't need to panic that that's passing you by. You can, as like Justin Knight did, you can, if you've got talent, you can show up and, or like Reid Coolsat did, both of them made the Olympics and there was plenty of time for them and neither of them needed to be going out for peewee, you know, year round travel track or whatever. I think we all have to accept that or understand that talent is real and that it does have an impact on what goals are realistic to set. But in the end, there are very, very few people in the world who can say, yeah, I ran as fast as my talent permitted. The talent is more of a theoretical limit than a practical limit. I would certainly say that my body was capable of running considerably faster than my best time. I will maintain to my dying day that I could have run faster than I did. And most runners believe that. And I think they're right, because talent sets a framework and it kind of puts you in a category. But ultimately, when you run a race, it's not like, oh, well, I ran as fast as I could, my talent stopped, and my talent ceiling stopped me. We're all far away from our true talent ceiling. So many things would have to go right for so long for talent to truly be a limiting factor. So I think, you know, as cliched as it is, you have to set your goals relative to where you are and a little bit higher than where you are. And, you know, it's fine to be interested by talent, to wonder. It's not like a taboo topic or anything like that. But it's a mistake to not set ambitious goals because you worry you're not talented enough. Because the only way you'll find out if you're talented enough for whatever that goal is to go for it.
Well, on that note of setting ambitious goals and going for them, Steve, you have a brand new book coming out soon called Do Hard Things. So give us an idea of what we can expect from it and when we can get our hands on it.
Yeah, so it comes out June 21st. So it's coming out soon. It's basically my exploration on the soft side, the mental toughness side, and trying to reframe and explore that, I think, in a way that runners will find extremely useful and also enjoy it, because I'm trying to move away from kind of the old school football, like grit your teeth and push forward and bulldoze through, to something that we're more familiar with, which is you're going to experience discomfort and you've got to figure out how to navigate through that. And sometimes that's through pushing through, sometimes that's acceptance, sometimes that's reframing. And it's really about creating that space to navigate discomfort so that you can do hard things.
So we'll include links to each of your websites in our show notes so that our listeners can learn more about you and all the great work you've both done. Steve and Alex, thank you both so much for joining me for this conversation. It was a pleasure chatting with you, and I hope we can do a lot more of it in the future.
All right. Thanks so much, Kate. Great to chat.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
In addition to visiting our guests' websites, you can also check out Alex's column, The Science of Running, in each issue of Canadian Running Magazine. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Shakeout Podcast. Subscribe to our show wherever you're listening to this episode. And if you're enjoying our content, please consider leaving us a review. It really helps other people find our show. Thanks as always for tuning in. Run safe and strong, and we'll chat again soon.